evaluating. See, he has to evaluate the pain versus the pleasure, and he has to evaluate the pain of cancer, emphysema, what it's going to do to his life, versus this pleasure. You see? Now, when you just speak it out like that, it sounds very clear which is the right one. I mean, like there's hardly an argument. It's so clear that you hardly have to think it through. Yet at the time that you have the desire for the cigarette, the pleasure becomes so much greater than the pain, like you can't even imagine that it's going to bother you.
Well, it's not greater.
You see?
The only real
so you're evaluating, in other words, if you even think about it, I mean, but there's a certain evaluation here that you've made, and that evaluation is irrational. I mean, we'd have to define the rationale exactly between the two. In other words, like you see by the example that I always give, that most people stop for red lights and these same people speed, right? So when it comes to a quantitative difference, you see, it's hard to evaluate. So it's hard to evaluate the pleasure. What the difficulty is the pleasure and the pain to evaluate these things, okay? The logics that we're dealing with is measuring opposites. Okay, we're measuring opposites. Okay, like for instance, hot, warm, and cold. You could measure hot, warm, and cold in different ways. Let's say you could talk about insofar as your body relates to the hot water, right? So this is where it's hot is where it scalds the hand, it burns the hand. Cold is where the hands become numb. And warm is where it's just right, where it's comfortable. Okay? So there's different, you have to evaluate physically the different degrees insofar as your hands are concerned. Now, since hot, warm, and cold in a different situation, like let's say, for instance, insofar as melting steel is concerned, right? Now, what's hot to the body is cold insofar as melting steel is concerned. So you always must evaluate. You must know how to evaluate different things, right? Now you have to evaluate the different. So you're evaluating opposites, and over here you're evaluating the insofar, since a person looks for the greatest amount of pleasure and tries to avoid the most amount of pain. And also in pain is the strength of the pain and how much it's going to disable you, you see? So you must evaluate that, all that, how much is going to disable you and how much, how strong the pain is versus the pleasure. Okay? Now, if you evaluate insofar as pain is concerned, the disability and the pain of cancer and emphysema compared to that one puff on the cigarette, I mean, what's the comparison? You see? It's what the logical mistake there is in evaluating pain and pleasure. You see, whenever you make a mistake, there must be a logical mistake. And here he's evaluating opposites that he doesn't know how to evaluate, especially when it's a quantity. And here, I mean, in the case that we're talking about, it's not even a quantity; it's a qualitative difference. The disabling effect and the pain that goes versus on the pleasure of smoking. You can't compare it to so far. You see? But he loses the emotion over there, causes him to lose the ability to evaluate. So what we want to say is that you must look at everything. The first thing you should do before you look at the emotion is to learn the logical mistake that you're making in your thinking process. It could be like we just showed you in everyday life, an evaluation. You see? Like, for instance, if a person tries to beat a red light, he only thinks, will he get caught? That's an incorrect way of looking at it. You know what I mean? The question is that you are training yourself to... Well, we have to work out the logics again. There are two psychological mistakes, okay? So what we're evaluating at this time is saving time, right? Because if you cut out the red light, you're saving time, right? That's all. I mean, forget about the emotions, what's really driving you. Could be competition or road rage or whatever. It could be many different emotions. But looking, pushing the emotion aside, but just looking purely at the logic, there is a situation that you could save time. You could get home a minute earlier. Okay? Now, there are two things, okay, and that's your evaluation. So therefore, it's worth it to skip, to cut the light, to go in the red light, beat the red light, you see, so that I can, be home 2 minutes early. Those are the facts. Forgetting about the motive. Okay? Now he has to evaluate that versus that pleasure that he gets from getting home the few minutes earlier, that versus two problems. One is he could first of all get into a accident here. This situation, is it worth the accident? That's sure not. But two is there's another thing, is that when you get used to doing things in a certain way, you continue doing it, and the first time you do it, you're very careful. But after a while, the nature is not to be careful, so you will evaluate worse as you go along. Your evaluations will become worse. In other words, when you evaluate the time to get home when versus the danger, you will put yourself in more danger to beat it out, to save the time, you see? But the thing is, but forget about that. That's already an emotion, the second part, that the emotions cause you to go worse. But the fact is that you're evaluating the saving of time versus the pain of going to the hospital. I mean, sometimes, you know what I mean, like the pain of, even if you don't get hurt, the pain of insurance and you're going to really come late. First of all, you're going to be late. Second of all, you have to deal with the car crash. Then you have to deal with insurance and all these things, you know what I mean? Like this. So you're taking a chance, and now let's say, for instance, now you have to evaluate. Let's say I do make it 20 times, but the 21st time I don't make it, okay? I've always beat out the red light. And the other thing happens, because I'm very careful when I cut the red lights. Now, let's assume, right? So then you have to evaluate the chances of, after a while, of disobeying the law, that you're going to get into it. Forget about getting caught, but the chance of getting into an accident, to a certain extent, it's going to, there's a certain point where you will, disobeying the law. So it's, over there, it's the evaluation of logics, and if it's in the opposites, we're evaluating opposites, you see, pleasure versus pain, and evaluating the pain versus the pleasure, you see. That is the irrationale of most of Mishlei is like that. Because that's, you know, we always look at, you're measuring the consequences, which is the opposite of what you wanted to get. You wanted the pleasure, and then you get the pain, you see. So you have to evaluate the pleasure versus the pain. You see, that is the logics in that area. All right. So I'm just trying to show you that everything boils down to logic. Now the same thing when you make a mistake in a shear and you take a step and you know the step is incorrectly, you must define it in terms of logic. What the logical mistake is.
All right. We're up to verse 7. That's Pasuk Zion. Says, when the wicked man dies, all his hopes are lost. And the second half is, his hopes of the wicked man is lost. Okay? The question is, what is the difference between the hope of the... they use two different words for the word hopes and wishes and desires. One is tikvah and one is tochelas. The Malbim seems to say that the difference is tikva hopes is like it's wishes that you could be successful at. Like, let's say you want $1 million, a person could be successful. But there's certain fantasies that a person has that's out of the realm of reality. So he says that's the difference between the two. Okay? But however, the Rabbeinu Yonah doesn't disagree with him, the Rabbeinu Yonah doesn't make a distinction. Rabbeinu Yonah says that the purpose of the verse is to come to tell you the degradation and the disgrace of the wicked, that all his hopes and his successes in the world, that he will not fulfill all his hopes and successes in the world. And he says when the Russia died, when he quotes the Pasuk, he says, and that's what the Pasuk means, that when the Russia dies, his hope will be lost. That the hope and success in this world of the wealthy and the powerful will end, all his hopes and wishes and desires will end with his death. Then he quotes the second half of the Pasuk, the hope of the wicked, he uses a different term for wicked, will be lost. So he says the hope of the wicked people are lost when they die. Okay? And then that's one explanation. Then the second explanation, he says, and further it is possible to explain that Tochelas Onim, the hope of the wicked, it doesn't mean, Onim doesn't mean wicked, he says it's those that depend on the wicked and his strength. Okay? So all this that they place on him, all their hopes that they place on him, will be lost when he dies. For most of them in their death. Okay? And then the third explanation is that the hope of the children, and he quotes a place that Ona means children, that the hope of the children of the Russia will die. That's all in the second half. He changed around the second half of the verse, okay? So those are the three explanations. So we're dealing with we'll start with the last one, which is the simplest, the children. And that is that we see that wealth never, let's take wealth, okay? Wealth never lasts longer than a few generations. So you can't say that all your hopes are dependent on wealth, you see, because first of all, the person himself, it only lasts while he's alive, and all his fantasies about how it's going to help him to exist forever, or if he's remembered somehow, how it's going to work, doesn't help him if he's dead. You know what I mean? If he's dead, all these wishes and hopes are gone. That's insofar as he is concerned. But insofar as his children, his descendants, no wealthy person is, even a righteous person, cannot give over the wealth to his children. Maybe for a generation or two, but then that's all. Then it moves on, the wealth. Not everybody, you can't keep wealth. So the thing is, it's something you cannot put your hopes into, or your wishes. It's good to have wealth while you're alive for practical reasons. But if you give into the fantasy of money, and you go after money because you think there's something there, that there's something special there, that fantasy is a total waste. That just ends when you die, and even if you give it over to your children, your children also, after a while, the descendants will not have it. If it's not your immediate children, it could be, you know, your grandchildren, your great-grandchildren. At some point, money goes away from the family. It's not going to be in your family forever. Okay? Now there are people that are dependent on the Russia. That was the second possibility. We started with answering the third. We went back to the second. Now, the thing is like you find that there is like Hitler was a very charismatic person, and he was very successful in bringing together the people. Without him, you couldn't be successful, you see. So therefore, they're dependent on that type of a leader, you see. Now, without the leader, then the followers are lost. In other words, sometimes you have a leader, and then let's say there's a certain system where you produce people that could be a leader. But sometimes leadership is a certain quality that they have. So the wicked people, his leadership is just like he didn't train to be a leader. He became a leader, and he has the quality of being a leader. So therefore, since you're dependent on his leadership, when he dies, so then all the hopes of the followers are gone. If, in other words, if the leader is very charismatic, and he's able to win over people, so then people follow him. But if, when he dies, there's nobody else to take over, so then the followers all fail. That's it. They fall apart. They were totally dependent. That's one way of looking at it. It's also like you're dependent on certain people, like religious people, or certain things that you're dependent on. If you're dependent on a particular person, in general, if you're dependent on a particular person, when the person goes, then you lose out because you will spend your life being dependent on it. The dependency, it's the dependency that's wrong. You see? When you have dependency on a certain leader, that's why the Torah teaches you to be an independent thinker. You have to follow a teacher only insofar as he helps you to be independent. But to follow a leader to be dependent on him, that is a dangerous thing. Because when the leader dies, then what do you have? Unless he gave you something, unless he gave you chachma that you could be independent. Oh, so then you will become independent. So when he dies, you're an independent thinker, so you're on your own. You see? That's the second explanation. The first explanation is, that whatever the father has, it's not necessarily the child will have. I mean, definitely power. Sometimes, even if he gives over power to a child, the child doesn't know how to do it. It very rarely lasts long. You understand? And they just fall away. Whatever he has is not going to last forever. So it's just not going to go on. You can't rely on that. The second thing is followers, that people that are by nature dependent, so they are dependent on the leader. So their dependency on the leader is lost. When the leader dies, so then all their hopes are gone. You understand? All the hopes of the people that are dependent on him are gone. You see, because you have a complete dependency. By Torah, it's just the opposite. Teach a person to be independent. So that's it. So after a while, even you might be attached to the teacher, but you're not dependent on it to exist. He gave you what he can give you, and you became an independent person. But if you're dependent on him, you become a dependent of him. That is a when he dies, you're lost. All right. Now we come to the first explanation. They were just talking about a wicked person and the hopes of the wicked person die with him. Like he had certain hopes of power, certain hopes of being wealthy. I mean, all these hopes are only in the physical world. And even if he reaches some of them, but that's it, it's gone after he dies. Okay? Now, the righteous person, on the other hand, there are two ways of looking at the righteous person. One is, first of all, he has a portion in the world to come. So therefore, even when he dies, he continues on. But there's also another way of looking at it, and that is this. That, one of the highest goals in Judaism is to be a part of God's will and God's plan. So the thing is like when God told Abraham that his descendants is going to take over, like God is going to relate to his descendants, why should that make Abraham happy? I mean, Abraham is a person, he doesn't have an ego, so the fact that his descendants will be part of God's system, so okay, fine. So what? So I mean, that's God's system. Why should that make Abraham happy? You see, the answer is that because God is part of because Abraham is happy that he's part of God's will. And he's causing, through his will, you see, there are things that are going to continue on. So he's happy about that it's going to continue on via him. Because, in other words, because I am doing God's will, so then I'm happy right now. In other words, while I'm alive, I am happy that the future will have certain things that
that I could in other words, I could be happy now for what that the future is going to get, because now, because I recognize that I'm part of God's plan. God's plan is that the Torah and ideas of Torah and ideas of justice should continue on, and so therefore, when I'm doing justice, acting out justice, I'm doing God's will. So therefore, that makes me happy. Okay, it is different than where I obey God. I'm going to obey God and keep halacha. That's a different. That's the beginning. When you start out, I know that God gave Torah and I must obey God, so I keep halacha. But this is a development of your personality, where your your desires are to do God's will. Now the question is, how do you acquire such a personality? The answer is like this. You must start out, like we said, that first you study Torah lo lishma, for an incorrect purpose, okay? Incorrect motive. Then what happens is there's a change from that, and you have a love of learning. It's part of the animalistic part of you that you really love this, the ideas. Then, since the ideas are real, so your life is guided by the ideas, and your emotions fall in line with the ideas that you have studied. In other words, see, when you first start out and you start studying, so then you might have certain desires which is opposite the ideas of Torah. But after a while, your emotions come in line with the ideas of Torah, you see. So then, when you live the life of Torah, that makes you happy, because your emotions are in line with your philosophy of life, you see. So once your emotions are in line with your philosophy of life, so then you're happy. Now, what if your philosophy of life, and through years of study, you recognize, is that all you should do is be a part of God's will? That you should try to carry out God's will based on your study of Torah, based on your knowledge of Torah. That's your desire. And your God's desire is that the Jewish system should continue on forever. So when you help the system, you are being part of God's system. So the future, your hopes and your desires will continue, because you're being part of God's system. So your hopes and desires will continue on even after you die, because it's part of God's system. You are helping maintain God's system, so therefore your hopes and desires will stay on after you die. And you enjoy it while you're alive. The question is, what is the difference between this and an ego trip? The answer is, an ego trip is that psychologically I desire to be the best. Here it's a result of my knowledge, that I live based on my knowledge, not on what I desired when I started out. In other words, let's say when I started out I desired to be, a chacham. I wanted to have the image of a chacham, but I really didn't enjoy learning. But I was just working for that image. Then I started to enjoy learning. You see? So now I start learning because I enjoy the learning. But then the philosophy that I'm learning, the ideas that I'm learning, affect my personality. Becomes part of my personality. It's not my ego anymore, it's the learning that affects me. I live based on my philosophy. Like somebody one time said, I don't remember who I heard it from, says, what's the difference between a philosopher and a philosophy teacher? See, a philosophy teacher just tells you over what the philosophers say. A philosopher went through all the possibilities and he thought it through and he holds one way is right. And he lives by that idea. If he doesn't live by that idea, he's not a philosopher. There are certain people that quote philosophies. Like somebody one time told me, says he went to a class in methodology of teaching. So somebody in the class says, teacher, says, is this such a great methodology? How come you're not using it? You understand? That is not a philosopher. A philosopher means that where the ideas are so real, his total personality is guided by these ideas. That's the only thing that's real to him. That is not an ego trip. That's reality dictating his life. Reality dictates his life. Because the mind tells him what reality is, and if his emotions fall in line with it, so then he is all his emotions are dictated by the ideas. But if you don't live by it, then you're living by your ego. That's ego. Or if you stay at the stage of lo lishma, incorrect view of learning Torah, it's all it only stays the lo lishma, right? The incorrect view. That's an ego. Then learning is an ego. You see? In other words, when I'm part of God's will, the desire is not to be that I'm going to exist forever. That would be ego. I'm just content that I'm living, that my whole philosophy is to be a part of God's will. And when God told Abraham that that his descendants were going to have Torah and live and be guided by God, so therefore he was happy because he saw that he was being part of God's plan, which is his whole desire. That's humility. See, ego is where I live based on myself, my psychological self. Here he lives based on reality. Humility is where I guide my life based on reality, and the self is not important only insofar as the reality is concerned. I'm only a part of the reality. I'm part of the system. That is humility. And he's happy when he's part of the system. So those are the three ideas from the pasuk. There's the child who whatever the father has, even if he gives him the power or the money, it could only last for a certain amount of time. Okay? Then there's the followers who are dependent on the leader. So when the leader dies, since he's like he has a charismatic personality, so then when he dies, that's it. So when the leader dies, so they're totally dependent. They have nothing. Now, the opposite would be a person that teaches, that educates his child through Chochmah, or educates his followers through Chochmah, and he teaches them to be independent thinkers, so they learn how to make decisions on their own. They really become independent, you see? So they will have something after he dies, you see? That is the Chochmah, you see? That's the opposite. And in the first part, we're talking about the Rasha himself. The Rasha, his hopes are this world. But when your hopes, all your desires is to be part of God's system, then since the future will continue on, so then you're part of God's system. So that, insofar as your hopes and desires are concerned, that will continue on as part of God's system. God's system can never be broken. So therefore, your hopes and wishes will always be there. Therefore, the Rabbeinu Yonah says that there's nothing to be jealous of a wicked person. Because by a wicked person, it means where his value system is the physical world. Something in the physical world, that's his value system. That value system is gone, you know what I mean? What do you have from it? You have nothing from it, you see? There's really nothing to be jealous of that person. But the person that is in learning, he could give it over to his followers or his children and make them independent so they will have something, it will continue on, or it will continue on by virtue of that he's being part of God's system. So therefore there's nothing to be jealous of the wicked person. We're up to verse 8. It says that a tzaddik will be saved from a trouble, and a Rasha will come in his place. Right? That's what it says. The Rabbeinu Yonah says that this comes to tell us about the greatness of a tzaddik and the disgrace of the wicked. And the verse says that sometimes there's a decree against the tzaddik, right? And the Rasha is given in as a kapara. Okay? The word kapara over here means that where a something takes the place for your, for, in other words, you deserve a certain punishment, and something takes the place of that. In other words, you deserve a certain, or you are getting a certain decree, something that comes out against you, and something takes the place of it. Like many times, like before Yom Kippur, we use a bird to, chicken to take the place of our sins, that he should dad take the sins and he should die instead of us. Okay? Now, that's what it means over here. That the Russia takes the place, the wicked take the place of the righteous. Okay? And the reason why Shlomo was saying this is, again, to distance a person from the jealousy of the honor of the wicked, and to look down upon their successes. Hey, before we answer the question, let's get some examples that will clarify this. We see that Haman wanted to hang Mordechai, and what happened was Haman was hanged in his place. Okay? That's the best example. And many times you find nations that wanted to wipe out Klal Yisrael. They wanted to destroy Klal Yisrael, and they don't exist anymore. You say these nations don't exist. Well, some of them exist in name only. Like, for instance, Greece wanted to destroy, when they were the most powerful, you know, they were the Greeks, they wanted to destroy Klal Yisrael. You don't see them. I mean, it's not the same nation, you know what I mean? It's just a memory. You know what I mean? Iraq. I mean, what was Iraq compared to, you know, like he wanted to get back to the, Saddam Hussein wanted to get back to Babylonia, you know, like the heyday. I mean, that's it. They're wiped out. A little nothing. You know what I mean? So you see that the wicked take the place of the tzaddik. What they, it seems, anyway, we see cases what they wanted to do to the tzaddik happened to them. And the question is that what the pasuk is talking about? Or is the pasuk talking about, in general, like somehow... Russia takes the place of the tzaddik. That doesn't sound reasonable. You know what I mean? It doesn't sound reasonable. But anyway, it doesn't sound reasonable because, first of all, does the Russia deserve to die? If he doesn't deserve to die, then why is he taking the place? If it's because it's a decree that he wanted to do, so then I could understand that. Yeah, understand that I say that he takes what he wanted to do, so God punishes him and causes to him the exact thing what he wanted to do. You see, but if just to take somebody else, you know, out of the blue, it doesn't sound reasonable. And all the cases that we have seem to be, it's where the decree came from a person. In other words, the decree did not come from God. There's a decree against a person from people. And those people that want to destroy the tzaddik, that it will happen to them what they wanted to do. You see, could be that, you know what I mean, like by Paro, he wanted to destroy all the children in water. How was he destroyed? He was destroyed by water. Could be the same thing. Hey, the question is, was the decree, when the wicked person decreed against the tzaddik, was that, did the tzaddik deserve that decree? Hey, the Malbim says that it's definitely, that he gives the example, that's like Mordechai and Haman. So we see that the Malbim is definitely learning the way we are learning. Okay? First of all, you have to say that this pasuk is talking about hashkacha process, God's personal intervention. This does not happen in the laws of nature. In the laws of nature, I mean, there are consequences. This is not just a consequence of your act insofar as the laws of nature is concerned. I mean, it's possible sometimes that it can happen.
But the odds are very far. I mean, there's certain things within your nature that causes you, that when you do evil, so then it causes you certain consequences, but not necessarily the same thing that I wanted to do to others. This is really Hashgacha Pratis, and definitely according to the Malbim, that he talks about Mordechai and Haman, that's definitely God's personal supervision. Okay? So we're not talking about the laws of nature. Okay? The question is how did the how did the Tzaddik get into this decree? So nobody seems to say, but it could be whether it's by accident or it comes in other words, by the laws of nature, or it comes in, or God decreed it. But the Matzudas David says that that he says, and because of the merit, the Gezerah is removed. The decree is removed. Okay? So the thing is that the that it could be a decree from God, and the Russia didn't, in other words, what the wicked person wanted to do to the Tzaddik, definitely insofar as civil law, like for instance what Haman wanted to do to Mordechai, was not legal. I mean, he just wanted to kill him. So he was doing an evil thing. Let's say God wanted this because teach Mordechai something. Let's assume. I don't know, but the thing is that the Russia definitely went too far. He deserves punishment because he went too far. But however, Mordechai had certain merits that he removed this decree, if it was caused by God. Or it could be that there was laws of nature that he got into a terrible situation, and the Russia just wanted to destroy him, and then God saves him. But either way, it's Hashkacha Pratis that God wants you to see in the world, that God wants you to see that evil is destroyed. That's the purpose of Hashkacha Pratis, to show you that there is punishment for evil. So therefore, it's done in this way to cause the wicked to be destroyed, so that people could see that God intervenes because of good and evil in the world. And this is another aspect of recognizing that the life of the wicked is not a good life. I mean, throughout Mishlei you see that you shouldn't be jealous of the wicked because of their own traits. They destroy themselves. But this is another aspect that you shouldn't be jealous of the wicked, because insofar if they really become ultimate wicked and they're going to destroy a righteous person, then they can take the place. So therefore, they can take the place of the righteous. And you see that actually did happen. Okay? So therefore, you don't feel jealous. You shouldn't feel jealous of his lifestyle, of his type of successes. In other words, I'm adding to the Rabbeinu Yonah. I'm really adding, because the Rabbeinu Yonah only says that this pasuk is only coming to teach you not to have jealousy of the wicked and his successes, because he can take the place of the righteous, and he can be destroyed. I'm also saying that also shows God's intervention insofar as good and evil is concerned. The question is, it seems to be that once a decree is made, so it has to be relegated to somebody. Like if you have a decree against the tzaddik, now that decree has to be fulfilled someplace, so therefore it has to go on to the Russia. Okay? That is the question. It's not that since there is a decree, so it has to occur. That's not how we're explaining the verse. But we're saying it's not that it has to occur, but that when the wicked is punished, when God intervenes, he intervenes in such a way that you will see that there is no doubt that God intervened in the laws of nature. Okay?
that there's no doubt that it just, things don't happen that way, you see. So when that happens, then you can see God's intervention. In other words, it is not the usual case in the laws of nature where a wicked person fails. He doesn't always fail exactly in the precise way what he did to others. There's different ways that he fails, you see. So the thing is, that is not Hashgacha Pratis. It's just all of Mishlei that the person that lives a life of wickedness, he will cause his own downfall through because of bad traits. Okay? But however, here we're saying that God's intervention, and God wants to make sure that you see his intervention, so therefore he does it in such a way that it's very clear that God is intervening. And the question is why is this in Mishlei? Okay? The answer is that because Mishlei is here to tell you that living the life of the wicked is all different types of consequences. He's also showing you that the life of the wicked is also their consequences based on Hashgacha Pratis, that is the God's personal supervision. So therefore that is also a means to the punishment of the Rasha. It's a way of punishing the Rasha, and therefore you should not be jealous of the successes of the Rasha, because besides laws of nature, but it can happen. It can happen, in other words, that God can intervene. And that you will see, you can tell if God intervenes, if it happens exactly equal to the, happens exactly equal to the, what he wanted to do will happen to him. In other words, it's just another way of destroying the wicked, so that you should not follow the wicked, and you shouldn't even be jealous of the wicked. Shouldn't even be jealous of the wicked. It takes away, after a while, you go after pasuk, you start seeing there's nothing to be jealous of the wicked. Verse 9 says, the mouth of a flatterer will destroy his friend, and with the knowledge of the tzaddik, he will be saved. Okay? So Rabbi Yonah says that he's talking about flattery, because the flatterer destroys his friend with his mouth. Because when he praises him in front of him with a greatness that is not found in him, okay, so you see he's defining flattery as that which you say to somebody which is not really there. Okay? It's false. So then he destroys his soul, and it becomes an abomination to God, because it says in the pasuk that all haughty people are an abomination. So how does he destroy the guy? Through flattery. So when he flatters the person, so the person becomes haughty, and that becomes an abomination to God. Then he says on the second half, but with the knowledge of the tzaddik, he will be saved. So the tzaddik will be saved from flattery with their wisdom, because they will not make a mistake in their soul to have haughtiness because of the praise that was given by people. And so does, and our sages also say that you should be a tzaddik and don't be a rasha. Even if they say to you, even if the whole world says to you that you are a tzaddik, you should be in your own eyes like a rasha. Okay? So therefore, you should, in other words, doesn't mean you should fake yourself out. Okay, let's leave this. We'll come back later to this. And he says that it's also possible to explain that with the wisdom of the tzaddik, their friends will be saved. The friends of the tzaddik will be saved, because they guide the people, which is the opposite of the trait of flattery, because it's not enough. It's not only that they don't guide them, but they praise them. That's the flatterer. But the tzaddik will talk to the person and speak to the person and show him where how he should be guided. The question is, maybe there's two types of flattery. There's a flattery that you
say falseness, and there's a flattery that you say the truth. Okay? Now, the Rabbeinu Yonah says clearly, he says that flattery destroys the that his friend with his mouth, because when he praises him before him with a greatness that is not found in him. Okay? Now, he just makes a general statement, and the person that asked the question wants to make a subdivision. Okay? Now, whenever you want to make a subdivision, okay, you must have a reason to make the subdivision. There's no reason to make the subdivision, then I should keep the universal. You could always make subdivisions, and you could always make these type of questions that maybe it's this and maybe it's that. And you're right. It could be logical subdivisions in two different ways. But if you're going to make a subdivision, that you must have a proof for it, and not there's no reason to subdivide. And I just accept the universal. It's only the contradiction that causes me to subdivide. And I don't see any contradiction at this point. He quoted the sages of saying that even if the whole world says that you are a tzaddik, you should be in your eyes like the wicked. Okay. That doesn't mean you should lie to yourself. Okay? It doesn't mean that you should lie to yourself and say that I'm a totally wicked person. But the thing is that and there's nothing wrong. See, I'm a tzaddik. So therefore, everybody says I'm a tzaddik. I am a tzaddik. So there's nothing. Therefore, there is nothing wrong with me. That's it. What he means that you should be in your eyes like a Rasha, that there could be qualities that are equal to wickedness. That there are traits that could lead to mistakes that could harm you, and that you should never stop looking at yourself to investigate yourself. To make sure that in other words, to make sure that you recognize your incorrect traits, to deal with your incorrect traits. So therefore, that's what it means by a Rasha, that you should be like a Rasha. You shouldn't allow flattery, or even if it's a true thing, it's a real compliment, you can recognize that something is true. But that should not take away from the fact that you do have faults and you have to deal with those faults. You say you should never stop looking at the faults. That's what it means. So according to Rabbeinu Yonah, compliment is when it's the truth. Okay? So the flattery is a lie, and a compliment is when it's the truth. Okay? That is the according to the Rabbeinu Yonah. Since we're dealing with flattery and compliment, so according to the Rabbeinu Yonah, that he says that flattery is a lie, and compliment is telling the truth, what is the subject of flattery and that the opposites of flattery and compliment are attached to? What subject is it attached to? According to Rabbeinu Yonah, the subject is praise. There's two types of praise. There's a true praise and a false praise. True praise we call compliment, and the false praise we call flattery. Okay? That's what it seems to be. Now we want to know the subject of the pasuk according to the Rabbeinu Yonah's first answer, which we just discussed. We want to know what is the subject of the pasuk. In other words, the pasuk is saying there are two ways of receiving flattery. Either you could receive flattery by accepting it, or you could receive flattery and evaluate if it's really true. In other words, whenever you hear somebody... Before, we can't know if it's a compliment or flattery, according to the Rabbeinu Yonah, until you evaluate. So when somebody gives you a compliment or a flattery, if somebody says something, praises you, you have to evaluate if it's a compliment or if it's flattery. If it's a flattery, then reject it. It's just not true. And if it's a praise, then then if it's really a compliment, so then you can say, yeah, it's true. But it shouldn't take away from, then the Chazal say that if it is a compliment, then that should not take away from looking at other parts of you. You shouldn't allow yourself to become haughty. Okay? But the subject is receiving praise, and there's two ways of dealing with receiving of praise. That's the first half of the verse. According to the second interpretation of Rabbeinu Yonah, we're talking about the first half of the verse is that the person gives you flattery and destroys you. The tzaddik saves you by telling you and guiding you to the truth, and telling you the truth, and telling you your bad traits so that you can correct them and get you in line with reality. And then through that, it'll also teach you not to accept the flattery, but it's talking to somebody else. So according to this explanation, the question is, what is the subject of the verse? We're reading the Rabbeinu Yonah again. The second answer, it says that the opposite trait of the chanaf, and then he defines chanaf, a flatterer, and not the opposite of the flatterer. He says, because it's not sufficient that he doesn't guide you, the flatterer doesn't guide you, but he praises you and destroys you with his mouth. There are certain theories in education that you should praise the child to drive them, okay? And they found that this is a catastrophe, because what happens is that you give the child a sense of himself beyond which he really is, and he can't live up. First of all, he can't live up to it, and he is just in terrible conflict because he feels that he should be here, and then in reality, he sees that he's not there. So it's a terrible conflict, and therefore, and also, he doesn't have to straighten himself out. You see, so when we say that he says chanifa, that he's a flatterer, doesn't mean that he's doing it for his own benefit. He could be doing it for your benefit. He might think that it's good for you. Okay, so the flatterer could have. We're not talking about the motives of the flatterer, because the motives of the flatterer could be to fake you out, or the motives to get something out of you, or you should think highly of the flatterer because you like that type of person, or it might be his motive is to help you, that he has a wrong view of how to help you. Okay, but both of them are flatterers, because according to the definition of the Rabbeinu Yonah, that a flatterer is lying, so it doesn't matter what the motive is. The result will be the same thing. All right. Since the pasuk must be a comparison from the first side of the pasuk to the second side of the pasuk, so we have to exclude the liar. Because, in other words, a person that's telling you only because of his own benefit. Because then there's no relationship between the second half and the first half. One is educating you for... it's like not the same thing. One is educating you, try to straighten you out through Musar and through telling you your faults and guiding you. The other is lying to you. I mean, there's no connection between the two. So it can't be talking about the flatterer that's doing it for his own benefit. So he's talking about a flatterer that's doing it for your benefit. You see? So therefore, that makes sense. So then there's two ways of trying to help a person with verbally, right? You could either flatter him to help encourage him to move on, right? Or you could tell him who he really is, to help guide him to where he really is, right? So therefore, and if one leads to destruction, and one leads to success, okay? The method of flattery of helping somebody will destroy him. The other way, it will be successful. Okay? So there are two ways of trying to help a person have a good life. Okay? That's it. There's two ways of trying to help a person. One is through praise and flattery, and one is through telling him, guiding him with the truth. You see? That is the two ways of trying to help a person. One is more acceptable in society, but it's more destructive. That's flattery. The other, people don't like such a person, but he is really the more helpful, and he will really help the people. And so the subject is guiding somebody else, and there's two ways of guiding a person. Okay? The question is what is the opposite of flattery? Is the opposite of flattery compliment, or is the opposite of flattery guidance? You know, teaching a person, educating a person in Musa, you see? The question is, which one is the opposite? In the first answer, the way we're discussing it, we discussed the opposite of flattery is compliment. But here, the Rabbeinu Yonah is definitely saying the opposite of flattery is tochacha, meaning guidance or musar, okay, or rebuke. In other words, when we ask this question, we're not talking about the first answer, but in our discussion in the first answer, we said that the opposite of flattery is praise. Over here, that's what we said, okay? Now he's saying the opposite of flattery is guidance, correct guidance, musa, to tell a person how to live and what he's doing wrong, you see, which is different. So the question is, how could flattery tolerate two opposites? I mean, which one is the correct opposite? The answer is that it's dependent on the subject. In one subject, if you're talking about two different ways of praising a person, then there's true and false praise. If you're talking about how to educate a person, how to help a person develop, then there are two different types of development, either praise or guidance, you see? So depending on the subject, then the opposite of flattery could change because of the subject. In other words, it's a different framework. In a different framework, the same thing could have a different opposite, only because it's in a different framework. In the same framework, they could not have another opposite. That'd be impossible. But in two different frameworks, they could, the same thing, like flattery, could have two different opposites dependent on the framework, which is dependent on the subject. We're not saying that everything has to have an opposite. The problem here was, the original problem, was here we have one thing that has two different opposites. I mean, that's not possible, that one thing should have two different opposites. The answer is, in different frameworks, you can have different opposites for the same thing, if it's a different framework. Okay, we're doing verse 10. It says, in the well-being of the righteous, the city is happy. And with the destruction of the wicked, their song. That's the verse. The Rabbeinu Yonah has two commentaries. He says, because the tzaddik does good, everything he does is good for the city and not bad. That's one possibility. Second explanation is, it is possible to explain it that everybody is obligated to be happy when the tzaddik has his well-being. When the tzaddik is good, it's good for the tzaddik, and everybody should be happy. And they should be happy with the destruction of the wicked. And that which it says, you should not hate your brother in your heart, the wicked is not in the category of brother. And our sages say, a prince or a leader in your nation, you should not curse when he does actions for your nation. And there are many, it's clarified by our sages in many times. And the difference between, so far, the difference between the first explanation and the second explanation is the first explanation is that with the success and well-being of the righteous and the destruction of the wicked, people will be happy. The second explanation is you are obligated to be happy. That's why he asked the question. Therefore, on the second one, since it says you're obligated, so therefore he asked the question, you should not hate your brother in your heart. And he answers, a wicked person is not your brother, so you have the right to hate him. You have the right to be happy. Well, are you obligated to be happy when he's destroyed? Question is, what's the difference? And we have a few questions here. The first one is that our sages say that by the Egyptians, when they were destroyed, there's a certain amount you're not supposed to be happy because God's people are being destroyed. God's creation is being destroyed. So that's one question. Okay? The second question is that there are a lot of times people are happy when a wicked person is destroyed. People are happy. It's a natural thing. What does he have to tell us? We're obligated. And how could you obligate a person to be happy? Either you are happy or you're not happy. Okay? I mean, how could you obligate? I could obligate you in an action. You could either like it or not like it. Too bad. You understand? You have to do it. But how could I obligate you to be happy? That's impossible. The first step that we should take is the difference between the first answer and the second answer. Is in the first answer, it's a practical thing. That people are happy with the destruction of the wicked. You understand? Because with the wicked, the wicked really, even their own people, they turn against after a while. They hurt people, and harm people. When they see they're destroyed, people are naturally happy. It's a natural happiness. And when they see somebody that always helps them and benefits, there should be a natural happiness. It's a practical thing where you see the practicality of the situation. So you see that naturally you are happy. It's a practical thing that people are happy with that result. So according to that, the question is, so what is the pasuk teaching us? Because the purpose of Mishle is not to just tell us certain results that occur, but it's supposed to tell us how to live. Okay? And since it's telling us how to live, the question is, what advice is he giving us in this situation? And the second question is that practically, that definitely there are certain places where if they saw a righteous person fail, there's a lot of people that would not be happy. You know what I mean? I mean, they would be happy. They wouldn't bother them if the righteous people failed or a wicked person is successful. A lot of them would be happy. Anyways, practically, we don't seem to see that the facts are true, that people are happy when the righteous are successful and when the wicked fail. Many times it's not that way, you see. So it's not all, that result doesn't always come about. That's the question. The question is where is the Rabbeinu Yonah saying what we said, okay? The answer is that if you read the Rabbeinu Yonah, he says, because the righteous are good to all, and he does not do harm. Right, so that is, seems to be saying that because he does this, you should be happy, right? But you're not obligated. In other words, people should be happy, but not an obligation, not like in the second half. Second half, he's saying you're obligated. Because the pasuk says, I'm sorry, the pasuk says, with the well-being of the righteous, the city will sing, right? So it says that the city will be happy. So the Rabbeinu only explains why they would be happy. It says because the tzaddik does good for all and he does not do harm. So therefore, the city will be happy. But the question is, that's not always true. And two, what is he telling us? We like to say in the first answer is that there is in other words, like this. If somebody has an incorrect view of life,
right? And when he sees the tzaddik successful, it bothers him. We're not talking about that type of person. We're saying that there is a person has to recognize objectively, in other words, objectively, the tzaddik helps the community. Objectively, the wicked person destroys the community. Throughout Mishlei, I mean, we learn how all the different ways and all the details of the of how the tzaddik helps, how the Russia destroys. Okay? So therefore, we're saying that you should recognize the you have to be a person that recognizes when you are when you are being benefited. Okay? There are people that simply don't recognize when they're benefited and when they're harmed. In other words, if somebody offers you drugs and he's your friend, you feel, yeah, sure, he's giving me a good time, I'm going to have a good time. But that guy is, you have an incorrect view of the harm of drugs, and therefore you think that this person that's offering you drugs is your friend. Really, he's wicked and he's destroying you. He's really destroying you. So therefore, therefore, what we're saying is that you must be a person that recognizes when a person does benefit for you and when a person is actually harming you. So you should recognize that when it's really a benefit and when it's really a harm. We'd like to repeat the answer again. We're saying that the pasuk is saying that you must be able to recognize when you are being benefited and when you are being harmed. If you are a person that doesn't know when you're being benefited or when you're being harmed, you see, so then the pasuk is advising you, hey, straighten your value system out and recognize how the tzaddik helps you. To recognize how the wicked person harms you, you see. So therefore, that's what the first answer is saying, that you must be able to recognize what benefits you and what harms you in life. That's the whole purpose of Mishlei, to teach you what benefits you and what harms you. What there's a way of recognizing in whether you have this level and how you relate to the person that really helps you and a person that offers you something that's really harmful but it feels pleasurable at the moment and he's really destroying you. So you have to really know the difference in who your friends are. Who is benefiting you and who is harming you. That would answer all the questions on the first answer. One of the questions was that people don't do it practically. You see a lot of people that are not happy when the tzaddik. So we're saying, yeah, you're right. There are people that are not happy when the tzaddik is successful because they have a wrong value system. And the pasuk is telling you, hey, straighten out your value system. What is practical and what is not? And if you can't recognize it in the tzaddik, let's say a tzaddik gives you. He tells you you're doing something wrong and he's guiding you. Now that's not a pleasant thing, and you say you get angry with him because he's harming you. You feel he's harming you. So that means when you're angry with him, it means with the tzaddik, then you have a wrong view of what is good for you. So you have to straighten that out. What is good for me? The tzaddik is really trying to help me. And I don't recognize that he's trying to help me. I only care that he's trying to, tell me what to do. Who's he to tell me what to do? You see? So I have a wrong view, have an incorrect view of what is good for me. Once again, the pasuk is describing that if you are not happy when a tzaddik is successful or when a wicked person fails, you see, then that shows you that you have an incorrect value system. I'll try explaining it a little better. And that is that, see, consciously, people do have, let's say you come to class and you have a correct value system, of course you'll study Torah, right? But emotionally, your emotions are not in line. How do you feel when a tzaddik gives you musa?
somebody comes over and says, look, you're doing the wrong thing, straighten yourself out. You understand? How do you feel? Well, that means if you get angry with them and you feel anger towards them, that shows you that that you have the wrong value system. You have to straighten yourself out. You see? That's what the pasuk is saying. Well, let's say, for instance, an evil person that really advocates, you know, the life of pleasure. You know, these rock stars and things. People look up to them. They look up to these sports people because they are licensed to all the pleasures in life. And they become your hero. Now, really, you say, yeah, I look up to them, but, you know, I also keep halacha, I keep this, I keep that, you know. But it shows that you have an incorrect value system. And when something goes wrong with them, you feel bad for them. You see? That shows an incorrect value system. I mean, to be on a level where you accept mussar, you don't care even how the person tells it to you, but you just listen to the facts, that's a very high level. I mean, that's years of working on mussar. You reach that level where a person, it doesn't matter if he tells you off or if he tells you, whatever way he tells you, you just listen to the fact, forget about his emotions, just look at the fact. Maybe he sees something about you that you don't see. And then after you think it over and you have answered all his questions, go back to him, because since he sees you that way, he might be able to answer the questions, and you can't. So you go back and then put yourself in that same situation where he could show you that you're doing something foolish. Why should it bother you? It's better benefiting you. You should definitely want to do this. You see, but that's a certain development, that's a certain level that a person is on. Now the question is, if that is true, so then what's the difference between the first answer and the second answer? We're telling you in the first answer that you're obligated to be on such a level, on a certain level, right? Now we're saying that, and then the second answer says you're obligated. So according to the way we're learning the first half, what's the difference between the first answer and the second answer? The first answer is an obligation to be on a certain level, and the second answer is an obligation to be on a certain level. What's the difference between the first answer and the second answer? The question is, what does he mean by obligation? Okay. Obligation means in Mishlei, not halacha. Halacha obligation means you're obligated to do a certain act, whether you like it or not. In Mishlei, an obligation is to be on a certain level and that you must make a plan to get there. Through study and through Musa, you must have a plan to get there. You see what I mean? So therefore, that's what it means obligated. You're obligated to start developing yourself and work out everything so that you start, your emotions are like that. Now, you can't force yourself. It's a result of the ideas becoming clear again and again. As the ideas become clear, So then it becomes, in other words, as you review, it's not only a matter of the mind seeing, but it's reviewing where the mind sees clearly each time, again and again, not memorizing, but reviewing, that objectively you think it over every step and every thought again. After a while it affects you and you start living a certain way. You see? That's what it means, obligation. It's not like halacha. Halacha, you're obligated to do the act, so that's it. Even if I don't feel like it, I do it. Over here, the obligation in Musa is to start working towards a certain personality. You understand? You're obligated to work towards this personality. In other words, what obligates you is when you see the value system of Musa. The logic obligates you and forces you. It's not an obligation like a halachic obligation. Logic demands that you be a certain person, so therefore you see that it's beneficial. It's not an obligation like it can't be an obligation in Musar. It can't be an obligation that I don't understand. It must be that I understand the value of being such a person, and when I understand the value of being such a person, that gives me the responsibility, instead of chiyuv, by obligation, I would say responsibility. I take upon myself the responsibility because I recognize the importance of it. You see? That's what he means by obligation.
It's not an obligation like halacha, whether I understand the reason for the halacha. All I have to know is how to do the halacha, whether I understand the reason or not, I'm obligated to do it. In Musa, you can't do it blindly. In Musa, you must see clearly what the benefit is, and when you see the benefit, then you take upon yourself the responsibility to develop your personality to reach that level. But you must see the benefit in working on it. If you don't see the benefit in working on it, that is not the Musa approach. In other words, if you do not see the benefit, since it's not Allah, I can't force myself to be on a level that I'm not. You can't force yourself to be something you're not. You see? That's totally foolish. It must be a natural... It's not like Allah where I force myself against my will to do some, the right act. Here, it's a natural result of my knowledge changing my personality. It's pure knowledge changing your personality, and it's the mind seeing clearly why I should do it, how I should do it, and the mind must see that this is the only way of living. You see, and there's no better way of living. You can't accept authority in this field. You must see it for yourself. You only accept authority insofar as you know that he is wise, and therefore, even though I don't understand it, he's probably saying the same thing, so I have to really figure out what he means, and I must work on it till it makes sense. That's insofar as I accept authority. In halacha, it doesn't even have to make sense if he tells me I have to stand on my head for 3 hours. That's it. I don't know why. I have to do it. I don't have to know why. That's not something Ishmael. I'm going to do it without understanding the philosophical reasons. But I do know they'll tell me how to do it, and I'll do it. Whether I like it or not, or whether I understand it or not. But here you must see the benefit, and then when you see the benefit, so then you take on the responsibility to start doing everything that is necessary to change your personality, and that's basically seeing the ideas. In the development of Musar, there are two levels, okay? One level is where I am totally selfish. And the thing is like in the first answer that we gave, is that there's a certain level for that I am selfish. In other words, there's two types of selfishness. Let's start that way. There's two types of selfishness. One type of selfishness is that I want to do what I think is good, but it's really harmful. Then there's a selfishness, I do the right thing because I see that it's beneficial to me, that it's a benefit to me. So there's two types of selfishness, a foolish type of selfishness and a wise type, an intelligent type of selfishness. Okay? Well, a person could be selfish and self-destructive. That's stupid. Okay? But then there's a person that's intelligent and he sees truly what's beneficial for himself and what not, and what's harmful. That's the way we learned the first part of the pasuk. We're talking about a person still on a selfish level. Okay? There's a certain level where you relate to the system objectively. You realize that this world works with systems. Everything works with systems. And the scientist that works in the system uses particulars only to understand the universal until the only importance of the particular is only insofar as the universal is concerned. You see? In other words, it's only he relates to the universal and to the idea itself, not because of selfishness, but because he recognizes that is the important, that, in other words, through study, and as you study the universals and concepts, you start relating to the universals to such an extent where the universal becomes the important thing. You see? So therefore, the second half is saying that based on the universals, you should be happy because he works in a system, and the tzaddik works with a system,
and he tries to organize the city based on justice, while the wicked only does stupid things and helps the fools live their stupid life. You see? So because he recognizes that tzaddik relates through a system, so he's drawn to that person through the system, and he's happy when he's successful because he relates to the system. Okay? That is, according to the second answer. The second answer really fits into the pasuk better, because the second answer uses the word city. You see, not a particular. Somebody asked before, why does it use the word, why doesn't it say every individual, why does it relate what the tzaddik and wicked do to a city? Why doesn't it relate to the individual? So that would fit better with the second answer, why he uses city, because city represents a system. You see? It represents the system. So therefore, that would fit in better in the with the second answer. Okay. Now the question is, why does he use responsibility in the second and not responsibility in the first? In other words, in his answer, he only says responsibility in the second answer and not in the first. You see, it's responsibility is some. In other words, insofar as he's defining the term responsibility in the framework of Musar, you see, I can't say you're responsible to be selfish. You can't say that. I mean, it is true, that's what we're telling you, that you should be selfish in an intelligent way. But the thing is, the word obligation is outside in other words, usually obligation is something outside of you. In other words, I don't want to do the halacha. It's not a natural. In other words, you don't have to tell somebody you're obligated to breathe. Everybody does it. You blink automatically. I can't obligate you. But that which is outside your nature, so therefore I can't use the word obligation. You see? This is, you're incorporating a change in your personality. See, the first one is you're still selfish, but you're selfish in a way of chachma, an intelligent way. There is a change in your operation, your modus operandi, and there is a change in your view of life. There is a change, but however, you still, the basic selfishness is still there. The second one we say, insofar as Musa is concerned, responsibility is where your whole personality changes. You're responsible to change your personality totally, that there is no more selfishness, but you just relate to systems and you make decisions because the system logically says you should do a certain act, so you do the act because the system says it. Even though you could see the bad benefit, but that's not what motivates you. It's not the benefit that motivates you, but it's your relationship to the system. The explanation, especially of the second half, okay? They one time asked Einstein what he thinks about his death, if he's going to die, how he feels about it. So he says, that's not important. It's not even worth thinking about. His own death wasn't worth thinking about. Now the question is, what does that mean? Okay? Now Einstein studied the universe, and when he related stars or to astronomy or to any facts in physics, he only related to it only insofar as the universals are concerned. After a while, his personality changed that he only related to the universals, you see? So his personal life, whether he's going to live or die, is not important. It's only the universal. He might discuss the idea of the soul, you understand? He might discuss the idea of what happens after death, like as an idea. But that he's going to die didn't bother him. Didn't make a difference. You understand? Because it's only a particular in a system. Okay? Now, when you start studying Musa and you relate to justice and kindness, we discuss it insofar as what is the benefit to you. But we also know that justice and kindness is part of a system, the way a city and a nation and an organization and a group of people should operate. You see, it's a certain system, okay, that justice and kindness is part of that system. You see what I mean?
Therefore, the thing is that when you first start out, the person must live according to what motivates them. You can't be motivated by something that is not part of you. Now, the first thing that the person has is selfish. And every person wants the best for themselves. So therefore, we show you how to live as an intelligent, wise person, that you will be successful if you live the life of Mishlei. And that is the most selfish thing you could do. And the other way, if you live selfishly the other way, you'll only destroy yourself. And that is not beneficial to you. So therefore, it's worth your while to investigate and analyze these ideas till you get the right view. You see? That's the first answer. And in other words, it is true when you start out in Mishlei. I mean, the question is that when you start out in Mishlei, you're going totally against your nature. So your selfishness tells you, why should I do that? You see? But logic will show you that is detrimental. That's why we call you a chacham. Because right now, it is painful to change, and it's easier to go based on your emotions, the way you feel. But you're a chacham because when you think it out, and your mind tells you that is harmful, so you're not experiencing the benefit. So you live according to your idea because you see that is most beneficial to you. The mind sees clearly that it's most beneficial to live the life of Musa. You see? Even though emotionally it might be painful to live the life of Musa because your emotions go the other way. You see? But still in all, logical selfishness, a rational type of selfishness, will tell you to go against your personality and live according to the world of Musa. Now, as you study for the selfish reasons, to when you study Musa, you start studying universals. It's an idea, it's a concept. But you use the concept as a means for your selfish life. But after a while, by studying it again and again, you relate to the universal itself. You become attached to the universal. That becomes your essential. That becomes your essence. That is your desire. So therefore, that is different. That is very different than the person that is that does it for selfishness. Selfishness is, I only do it for myself. The other one is more like Einstein, where it's not, the particulars are not important. What is important is only the concepts and the ideas, and he relates to the concepts and ideas. The question is, what is the universals of Mishlei? Okay, the most universal of Mishlei, the most universal idea is that it probably is Ezehu Chacham Aroes Hanolad, who is wise? He who sees the results or consequences of his actions. And Sadia Gaon gives an introduction to Mishlei by saying that the purpose of Mishlei is to evaluate your immediate pleasures and pains versus your future pleasure and pain. In other words, Sadia Gaon says that every human being is drawn to pleasure and wants to avoid pain. When you start out, you go to the immediate pleasure and you avoid the immediate pain. But however, the concept, the idea, when you analyze it, you see beneath the surface and you start seeing the concepts based on ideas of why you should live a more rational life. Those are the universals of Musa. And every pasuk shows you a different universal about different areas of the... In other words, they're a little more particular, but it's still a universal in this idea. Okay? And slowly but surely, you start relating to the ideas. Like for instance, in our pasuk, there are two universals. Okay? You could relate to a tzaddik and a rasha for selfish reasons in a correct way. In other words, I relate to them because I have a true value system. So when I see the success of the tzaddik or the failure of the rasha, it makes me happy because personally I'm a happy guy. You see, that's one idea because I see the benefit to me. That's the first idea, universal. The second universal is that when I relate to a tzaddik and a rasha, I relate to them insofar as how they relate to the city, to the system, to a system. So I relate to him via ideas based on a system. That's the idea. That's the two ideas in this pasuk, according to the Rabbeinu Yonah. There's two possible interpretations of the pasuk, and that is what the Rabbeinu Yonah is telling us, the two possible interpretations. Those are two universals. In other words, the nature of a person, there's a certain person that is selfish, but he's intelligently selfish. There's another person that is not selfish, he does not think of the self, but he naturally relates to universals. This is two ideas. Now you might come across this same idea in another pasuk from a different angle. So then you'll have the same universal, and after a while you start thinking of the universals of Musar. And then you can relate to the universals of Musar after a while, and not through the selfish means, but through the universals. In other words, the reason why there is obligation in the second one and not the first one, because here it's obligation is being used as a metaphor. Okay, what is obligation in the true sense? True sense is something I don't want to do, and God has to obligate you. God doesn't have to obligate you to blink your eyes, okay, because that you can do anyway. Okay, God has to obligate you in something that I might not do. Okay, in Musar, in other words, in the world of Musar, obligation means it's not in line with your selfish desires. Just like the obligation, I don't feel like doing a mitzvah. It's bothersome. It takes away from something. But I force myself to do it. So it's the quality that it's not the obligation over here means it is a metaphor, meaning that it's not part of my natural nature. My natural nature is to be selfish. That's where I start out. This obligation has the quality of obligation. It's outside of your personality. So therefore it uses the term obligation, but it's only a metaphor of obligation. It's a change to from what we said to begin with. Okay? And insofar as summing up and defining the difference between the first answer and the second answer, in other words, we're saying there are two levels in the way to relate to the correct way of relating to a tzaddik or to the success of the tzaddik and the failure of the rasha. There's two ways of relating. I should be happy because practically the tzaddik is good for me, and if I have a correct view of what is good for me, so I'm happy when the tzaddik is successful and the rasha fails. Okay? The second level is I identify with the tzaddik because I relate to universals. And since he is part of the universal and he relates to universal, so I identify with him through the universal. You see? So therefore I'm happy for him. So there's two different levels of relating to the success of the tzaddik and the downfall of the rasha. And the question is, what is the difference in the approach to the